Okay, welcome back again. Merry Christmas to all of you. From all of us, we wouldn't be doing this if we didn't care about all of you. And it may not be the happiest of subjects, but it is the topic that we have been given, and it is a worldwide issue. As I mentioned earlier, Paraguay has now shut its borders down, and you're going to see this in more and more countries. I'm afraid here we're going to have similar transit restrictions on the unvaxxed. War on the unvaxxed is one of the top agenda items for 2022. So be ready. Anything you want to add to there, young lady?
No, let's keep moving forward.
Nurse Anne is back with us tonight. Now, she has been more than brave and courageous in doing her job, trying to help people under impossible circumstances in major hospitals. She moves around. She knows what's going on in there, and she was with us, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, and offered to come back on Christmas Eve, and I think it's that important that we do this, and I'm very grateful to her for coming back. Nurse Anne, can you hear us all right?
Yes, I can.
Hi. Say hi to Erica. She's right here.
Hello, Erica. How are you?
Hi. I'm good, Anne. How are you?
Good, good.
All right, the lead question is, what are the trends and how have things changed or intensified since you were here last? And what is the... Oh, first of all, what is the... Now, you've been at this 30 years, right, plus?
26 plus years.
All right. Yeah. What size hospital are we talking about here? Big, medium, big?
It would be a medium, big-size hospital.
Okay. All right. Now, back to my first question. What's changed? What trends are you seeing? We'll start with that and just take it from there.
Yeah. The typical age groups we're seeing coming in that are the sickest of the sick at this point would be falling in the categories of the between on 40s, 50s, and 60s. I have not worked with the younger population directly since the last time I spoke with you guys.
Okay. Now, the last time...
We've had some very young deaths. We've had some babies pass away and teens. The most recent one was a 17-year-old.
Okay, let's get to that in a minute or two. You did say last time that you were away for 4 or 5 weeks or 6 weeks and you went back to work and the demographics of the average patient had changed. And I guess that change is still holding. We got 40s, 50s, and 60s now. There are younger people in there, younger adults,
yeah,
correct?
That's correct. Yeah, there's the middle adult is definitely been seemingly harder hit, but it's not actually discerning as to why it's that particular population, other than the fact that it seems like that age group, the 40s and the 50s and some people in the 60s, were still people that would have been employed. And probably my only thing that I can guess is that they were required by employers to get the vaccination.
Okay. Now, I have one more question, and then we'll pitch it over to Erica. These people are in there. I don't want to lead any of my guests, but I'm going to set this up by simply repeating what I've said many times. I do not personally believe these people are in there with COVID. I think most are in there because they have been vaxxed. Their immune system is beginning to die, and the door is open to all kinds of viruses, bacteria, and major organ disease and malfunction. Is that a fair statement?
That would be a very true and fair statement. What seems to be happening in this age group is they're presenting with either they've got some they become very fatigued. They've got abnormal labs. Typically, their hemoglobin is in the toilet. Like one lady came in and her hemoglobin was less than 5. Her platelets were like over like 3,000. And she was requiring multiple units of blood products.
Transfused with tainted blood.
Transfused.
How clever.
Tainted blood, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the thing about her case is that she had been diagnosed with cancer, but had been given her last chemotherapy 6 to 8 weeks ago prior to this incident.
Hmm. What was she in there officially for?
So they basically admitted her because she was very anemic.
Mm-hmm.
And she had basically been requiring the blood products, and her cancer was Hodgkin's lymphoma was the cancer that she'd been treated for.
Mm-hmm.
But she'd had a pretty extensive history as well, like a medical history, which is also not untypical of any of the people that I've talked with, that I will talk about tonight. They all have extensive histories. Typically, you'll see they'll have a cardiac history. They'll have hypertension, and they'll also end up with some form of a sleep apnea or respiratory-related issue. The other people that were hit hard this time around were people who had been officially diagnosed as abusing alcohol or substance abuse. They were coming in and they were very, very ill. And they were presenting with an encephalopathy type of thing, or some form of altered mental status and seizures.
Encephalopathy. Mm-hmm. Was it diagnosed any further than that?
Actually, yeah. There was one case where they went and they did the MRI of the brain and the spine because they thought maybe it's infectious. Maybe it was something that, as opposed to directly related to alcohol abuse.
Well, or encephalitis, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so they did a lumbar puncture as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did that, actually the lumbar puncture started to reveal some abnormal cells. And but ultimately, what it came back to is that they'd end up with some sort of this one particular case is had a clot. But it was a small clot, but it was in the part of the brain. So they were put on anticoagulants.
So there was a brain clot, and there was some encephalopathy, at least indications thereof. Now, that's
yes.
BSE or TSE, transmissible spongiform encephalopathy, which is usually prion disease. Mad cow, if you want, or mad deer, if you like deer. Are you seeing, my last question, are you seeing encephalopathy diagnoses more now than you were in, say, years past?
Yeah, I would agree. There is definitely, when they come in with an altered mental status, they're usually trying to see related to either encephalopathy as a rule out stroke. We saw a lot of strokes, a lot of strokes. A lot of the arteries in the brain were involved with direct injuries from clots.
Hmm. Ouch. Erica?
So when you look at their labs, their chemistries, is their iron out of whack?
It is. That was another thing that was happening. We see low hemoglobins, and the patients would be presenting with black stools, and so that they either usually that's an indication of like a GI bleed, gastrointestinal bleed, or there's iron, and the passing iron through the system, but the iron levels were off dramatically as well, and everybody, every single one of them had D-dimers that were super elevated. But that was not a new phenomenon, because I saw that when I started working with the COVID patients in the beginning.
Right.
Like
that was
D-dimers in the 3000s.
Yeah, that was kind of characteristic of that clinical presentation. So it almost seems as though they've taken the worst part of the virus, being the spike protein, and incorporated into this so-called vaccine, and now you've got the same clinical picture, but it almost seems as though it's more aggressive. It's an accelerated form of the disease that you have almost no chance of overcoming, because your body's producing the toxic protein, not some virus. So
because they're vaccinated as well. I didn't see anybody that wasn't vaccinated. That's the thing. Like, I get any patient I work with, I get to see their whole chart, and every one of them are vaccinated in my scenario
that I work with. It lends to what I was saying, that the vaccine, the so-called vaccine, which is not a vaccine, is giving people the disease called COVID.
Yeah. Yeah,
because I think
are there something else there, but that we're missing. I don't know I go in there now and I'm like, is there something else they're missing that they haven't found yet?
Right.
Or can detect? Because listen, they're still doing the PCR test. You know, that's the run of the mill test that they do when they come through the ER. The PCR tests have always been questionable as a good tool to use for that kind of disease. So, but the bigger issue I had in the last couple of weeks, I would say the last two, is the patients are young, and I'm saying young because they're in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and if they're not responding to the treatment therapies like anticoagulation, or if they are not responding to, like this one person came in, and for example, and I read the chart and I was thinking their chances of walking out of here are very slim, and the reason was because they came in with every possibility of a disastrous diagnosis or history. They came in and they had bilateral PEs to start with, and so pulmonary embolisms. Then they had clots in their lower extremities, so DVTs. Then they had a really bad situation going on with their heart, to the point where now they couldn't breathe properly. So they were respiratory compromised. So they ended up in the surgical ICU. And in the surgical ICU, they had to be intubated. They were intubated and put on a respirator. And they'd been there since late October. And it tried twice to take the patient off the ventilator and failed. So the patient ended up having to have a trach placed. Mm. So the trach was placed in around the end of September, because the family were still debating about all of this. But the history on this patient was unreal. I mean, they had every possibility that could go wrong. Like, they had a dilated right ventricular, they had an atrial enlargement, they had AFib, they were already on Eliquis, by the way, which is also a blood thinner that people take at home. They had mild mitral valve regurgitation, and they had moderate tricuspid regurgitation, where the valves of the heart are failing. And then on top of that, the patient had pulmonary hypertension, sleep apnea, and COPD.
And how old was this patient?
55.
Oh, boy. That's a lot. That's a lot to go wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the blood thinners that they were taking,
and
are they still there? Are they still with us?
Yeah, they're still there, but they're on the trach. They're still on the blood thinners. They're still having the echoes done on their hearts. They're still having the initial echo before this hospitalization was like 55-60%, and I think that the last echo that was done on this person is now 35%. So there's a lot of damage done to that heart already.
So you're having to use more than one type of anticoagulant?
So we're using heparin when it's this aggressive, when they're coming in this sickly, and the clots are in multiple places. I mean, the PEs. That's automatic. You're going to be put on heparin.
Right.
And then we tried weaning off the heparin and putting them on the, we'll either go with Coumadin or we'll go with Eliquis. But typically the hospital sticks with the Eliquis. But I'm finding Eliquis is no longer effective.
Wow. Huh.
And a question. Does anybody in the hospital beside you understand that once someone is vaxxed, it is very likely, irrefutably so, that they may very well be producing microclots around the clock? Doesn't stop.
Yeah.
That's what the spike protein does. Now, in some cases, these microclots could be yielding a larger noticeable clot. DVT type, I don't know, whatever. But the point is, we have, apparently, from what I'm hearing, is we have clots common in these people, clots of all kinds, all sizes, and located all over the body. These are not microclots. These are bigger. Is that correct?
Yeah, the clots are very big. I mean, and they've gone in and they've evacuated some clots from areas of the body where they could. And they are large clots. For sure. Now, the discussion with the staff, for a while there, no one would say much. But this past week, staff started this, like, talk amongst themselves. And they're one of the reasons it came up as a conversation is, oh, my gosh, if you can believe this, is the hospital is basically saying they are talking about having the staff do a booster. And so the discussion. I know.
You mean they're going to ask you to go around and inject booster shots into some of the people in the beds?
No.
For the staff.
They want their staff. Their nursing
just staff.
Staff
only. Oh, not patients.
Yeah.
Just staff.
Not patients. No.
And who's
not patients.
Who? So you're supposed to get these shots at work. That's what they want.
Mm. Well, yeah, and the one thing about this hospital I will give it to them is that they're allowing you to sign a form to say you're declining it. There might become a time when you, as a staff member, you may not be able to do that.
I would think that's quite probable over time. They're going to keep ratcheting this down and tighter and tighter. Does the staff understand that they've...
The staff are asking questions. They're definitely... The nurses amongst themselves now, this was the first week. I think they're nervous about discussing this subject matter because you don't really know everybody that you're working with at the time, but they're starting to talk amongst themselves now, and they're questioning a lot of things. And the reason they're questioning it is because they're looking at the charts and they're seeing the patients are vaccinated. And our sickest population is vaccinated. at this point.
It took them this long to add one plus one?
Well, I was not always at this hospital, but yes, that would seem to be the case. Or otherwise, there's a little bit of... there's a level of uncomfortableness about it, too. They're afraid.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah,
of course, of course.
Yeah.
All right, so how much of the staff you work with, this is just give me a round guess, a guess. How much of the staff you're working with, professional health care providers, have taken the shot or were coerced into taking the shot? What's the percentage?
The shot, all of them are 100% vaccinated. The staff that refused to take it were actually,
gone.
They were let go.
To put the workload
very
now.
Short.
The workload, I was going to ask you. So what's the workload now?
The ratios are very high. In the ICUs, they'll push you with, depending on how sick the acuity of the level of patient is. But you can easily now go, in the ICUs 4 or 5. And if the patient then that you might end up with another person in that event as well, if they're viewed as not being as acutely ill as the rest of the patients in there. So you're looking at, 4, 5, 6 patients, depending on the night that you have in it and the level of staff that the hospital has.
You don't have time to sit down. You're
no,
legally,
and that's the thing. I never get a break. I'm on my feet the entire 12, 13 hours I'm there. And another thing that has happened, which is very, very sad, and I'm going to say this, because I think it should be said, but one of the other things that's happening. And I was a hospice nurse, so I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say that I have struggled with this one very personally. So I had worked for a hospice for about 2 years. And the patients now, when they get to a point where the point of no return, where they feel that medical intervention has failed, and we can't do much more for them, there's this discussion about the do not resuscitate, do not intubate, and make them comfort care. Well, that's fine if that's what the family wants. But the thing about it is the level of aggression towards making them comfort care is very, very high. And this week I worked with a group of palliative care physicians who wanted this particular patient medicated with Ativan, Haldol, morphine, and Robinol every 4 hours.
To make them comfortable. To try to make them comfortable, or what was the agenda?
This is what they say, to make the patient comfortable. But the patient was so sedated from the first doses they got that he didn't require any more. And he didn't really need to be medicated every 4 hours. But they were adamant about making sure the patient got them. They weren't ordered as needed meds. They were scheduled meds, which means as a nurse, we have to give them. So the patient didn't really require them. I was a hospice nurse. I had a big problem with this one. And the patient didn't require all of those meds. Maybe he could have done with the Robinol, maybe he could for comfort, but maybe the Ativan. But the Ativan has a very long half-life, and it stays in your system a very long time. So pushing Ativan every 4 hours was basically taken, this is my point, it took away the dignity of dying from the patient. He doesn't get to die in dignity. He's heavily medicated. He's heavily sedated.
He's just a drooling, semi-conscious piece of protoplasm. That's not okay. Ativan is commonly used for sleep.
It can
people
be,
use that for sleep.
And it's used for anxiety or people
that,
who have agitation.
But you're saying this is really a bad drug because of its half-life.
Well, Erica, you who speak to it too, Erica, but it has a very long half-life. It stays in your system. And think about this. If you have a system that's already failing and shutting down, your kidneys are shutting down, and you're not filtering, and your liver is shutting down, that's not filtering correctly, those drugs aren't going anywhere. They're in your system. And this man was talking to me two nights before this incident happened.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody essentially decided he was terminal and to just increase these meds. Yeah.
To increase the meds.
I read a similar report today in one of the social media. I didn't know if it was true or not, but this person was talking about how when they intubate somebody, they really jack them up with all kinds of sedatives, tranquilizers, and the list was long. It was four or five different meds just to keep them completely sedated and basically comatose.
And it will shut down their lives. You can't do that to people because you'll override their autonomic nervous system and they'll just stop breathing or their heart will stop.
Well, they're in a vegetative state.
Correct. This is not good. Nurse Ann, I'll just call you Ann. Ann, I've got a question, and this is a real big issue. If we are correct in what we are told about remdesivir, they decided that it was the only, actually, it's one of two, but they decided it was the only real drug to prescribe for so-called COVID patients. Well, last year, as we know, last winter, the flu went away. It just vanished, according to the government. There were only 2,300 cases, whereas the year before there were over 50 million. Now, when somebody comes in there, I don't care what they have. If they have a bad cold and they've got upper bronchial congestion, they don't even have to have pneumonia. They're put on an IV bag, and then they're given remdesivir. And that brings the hospital $8,000 a day. One bag of saline with remdesivir added is worth $4,000 to the hospital. Two a day, eight. 7 days, $56,000 worth. Profit. And we know those drugs don't cost that much. How much remdesivir use are you seeing now? Is it changing? Is it common? What are you seeing? Can you hear me, Ann? Can you hear me, Erica?
I'm still here.
All right. Looks like we lost Ann for the moment. I wouldn't be surprised. Seems they cut you off, too. Five times now?
Yeah.
It's very easy for them to do that. They don't want information going out. They'll just shut the phone down. Todd's on.
Sorry, I lost you guys.
Yeah, no, you were cut off. That's what they do.
Oh.
All right, back to my question. Did you hear any of what I said about remdesivir and how much profit the hospitals make?
Oh, I didn't hear your comment, but I am aware of it because I was there in the beginning.
Let me rephrase what I said. Remdesivir is a killer. Everybody knows it now. The secret is out. Fauci's big secret is out. It's the only drug that the government wants people in hospitals to use on COVID victims, whatever that means. Can mean anybody with any kind of a bronchial distress issue. Mm-hmm. Anybody. So it's worth, the hospital earns or charges for two IV bags a day, each with remdesivir, $8,000 a day. $56,000 profit in 1 week just from using remdesivir, which will shut the kidneys down and flood the lungs, and the person goes on the vent and then out the back door to the morgue. So this is so brutal and heartless. It's murder. And my question to you was, are you seeing any change in the use of remdesivir since you were here last? Is it still commonly being used?
Still,
What's going on?
It's still the one that's been used. It's still, the physicians are basically ordering it for any of the patients who come in with the diagnosis COVID. Now, keep in mind, those tests that are done in the emergency room are done on the PCRs, which were originally done for influenza A and B. So if you don't differentiate between influenza A and B and you just happen to go and call it COVID, you're already treating the disease incorrectly.
Yep. And the poor patients have no advocacy. They're stuck there.
No, because
unless...
they're not allowed. Their family members aren't allowed to stay at the hospital. The hospitals are actually
they
sending
cut them
people
off.
Away again. Yeah.
So the patient is really sick. They don't feel well. And they'll just give them remdesivir. And the patient won't be able to say anything much. They won't know what to say because they're not educated about this. But that's how they kill people.
Yeah.
And they may, if they put somebody on a ventilator, the last I heard it was $33,000 paid to the hospital. Just diagnosing someone with a rubber stamp, COVID, is worth $12,000 or $13,000. This is big money. And that doesn't count the room charges, all the labs, everything else. So this is really, this is a death factory. Many of these hospitals are running like a death factory.
It's pretty frightening because the families, when they do bring in their loved ones, they are, the panic that is set out in the community with, oh, if you have a cough or a fever, you've got to go to the hospital because it could be COVID.
Oh,
well,
God.
The problem with all of that is that once you're at the hospital, you're getting admitted if you do that PCR test and it shows up, you know, if it tests positive, you're going into the hospital. But you're not going in with a loved one. You're not, your family are not going in. You're going in alone as a patient. And now you have to navigate a very confusing medical system.
And who knows what remdesivir is? Nobody knows what remdesivir is to speak of. People listening to this program do. But the mass general public doesn't. Erica, when somebody goes into a hospital and they're diagnosed with COVID and they don't have COVID, which is probably the majority of the positive diagnoses, they don't have COVID. We don't know what the hell it even is. And they are given remdesivir. That's a one-way ticket to the mortuary, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that drug was shown to be toxic. They tried to use it for Ebola and it failed miserably. I mean, it's toxic. And then they repurposed it for this thing. But it was known to be toxic 5, 6, 7 years ago.
These patients don't have a chance. They're sitting ducks. They don't have any advocacy. They don't have any education. They have no informed consent about any of the treatment because, and they sign it away, right? When they go in?
Yeah.
They sign it away.
They do. Yeah. And, they agreed to the admission and the treatment. Where they go after that is decided by how they present in the emergency room. If they're in any way respiratory compromised severely or cardiac compromised, they're definitely going to be going to the ICUs.
Wow. Erica, did we lose you? Yeah, they cut her off too. Well, the boys and girls, wherever they are, having fun tonight.
Yeah.
All right. Are you back?
I'm back.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's one for each of you. It's Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. You got to be, got to share, right? Share. They don't like this information being put out there, so they're just hassling. They're hassling us. All right. Erica, your turn. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that you know, there really isn't, I don't think, a case to be made for remdesivir under any circumstances based on its toxicity, and then to be prescribing it based on a PCR test that they've already admitted is unreliable. It was never intended to be a diagnostic.
It's being dropped permanently forever on December 31st, never to be used again for this charade that they're pulling off. This has been 2 years of essentially mass murder in my humble view. I'm not speaking for Anne or Erica. Mm-hmm. I view this as mass murder.
Oh, it is.
When,
yeah. I agree. I mean, a lot of the things that I've seen in the last couple of weeks is, and that's the thing, like, they're young. They're young people. They're coming in, and it's a lot of strokes. People who never had strokes before, they present with one side of their body being weak, and the speech was affected as well. They'd be aphasic. Many of them were found by their loved ones at home, unresponsive. And then you'd do the CT, and you'd see, like, things like an acute, acute-like clots in the MCA was a big one. The PCAs was another one. And there was a couple of times where there was occlusions on multiple sides. I mean, those were the patients that truly would not make it when it was on both sides. And the kicker was, this was the kicker, the patient would have had in their history AFib, and they would have been on Eliquis at home.
Okay. I'm also continually interested in the idea of this spike protein doing so many things. We could make a list of things that it is alleged to do. The people that made it, it's a synthetic protein. Remember that. This was manufactured. Right, Erica? Or tweaked?
Yeah, it's a designer protein.
Jeez. All right, here's Ann, I don't know if you've heard this. This is a doctor in South Africa. He's going to, there's about a 12-minute piece. I'm just going to play about a minute of it. But he talks about his professional opinion about the spike protein.
Why is that there? Now, the most important thing I think for us to understand is that the pathogen that was causing all the death in COVID illness. Now, I use the word COVID illness because we haven't really isolated the coronavirus that causes it. But in COVID illness, the pathogen is spike protein. And spike protein is what the vaccine is meant to make in your body. So if I had to give you my opinion as to what is happening on a global scale, and a lot of the work that I'm doing behind the scenes is in this direction, spike protein is one of the most contrived toxins or poisons that man has ever made. And the aim of this toxin is to kill billions without anyone noticing it. So it's a poison with an agenda. Now, we've got an engineered virus, and we've got a mandated vaccine that follow on each other. So basically, what looks like has transpired here, they've engineered a virus and put on this weapons-grade package onto it called spike protein.
Pretty smart, huh?
Yeah.
So that's the game. So these people who come in to your hospital and all hospitals are being treated by healthcare professionals, many of whom understand what they're doing, and they're still doing it. Oh, I have my mortgage. I've got to take care of my family. I understand that, but what they're really doing, well, let me relabel them. They are accessories to murder. Either willfully or out of ignorance. These people are being killed in that hospital. You don't go from 50 million cases of influenza 2 winters ago to 2,300 last winter. Those people had flu, and they went into the hospitals, and they were given remdesivir and falsely diagnosed with COVID and killed. That's how they did it. Is that an excessive statement? Anne, or is that correct?
I've never seen. I'll be honest. I've never seen anything like this. This is. I would have said it's baffling, only for the fact that there's so many people that I've seen over the last number of months now, and that they're all vaccinated, and yet they're coming in presenting with massive strokes, like MIs, respiratory failure, requiring intubation, requiring life support, requiring very invasive procedures to remove clots, requiring anticoagulation. I mean, I've never seen that. I mean, I've just not seen that on such a grand scale. Now, stroke has always been a risk for people that have had other comorbidities, but certainly not at this level. And again, I go back to the 40-year-olds, the 50-year-olds, and the 60-year-olds.
All vaxxed.
Vaxxed. All vaxxed. 100%.
The campaign to blame somehow the unvaccinated, those who choose not to take the bioweapon, as being evil and a threat to society, is that being passed to staff in the hospital?
Well, the staff are seeing it now for themselves. Staff are definitely asking questions. Like they're actually saying things like, if you get a vaccination for something and you are vaccinated for a disease, then in theory, that disease should no longer be an issue if you're vaccinated against it. I mean, that's how a vaccine works. So they start talking amongst themselves and they say, well, why are we seeing people who are vaccinated, not just once or twice, but three times now, we're seeing them come in and be admitted with a diagnosis of COVID for the very disease that they were supposed to be vaccinated for in the first place.
But
so people
Anne,
are
how
asking questions.
How could it take them 2 years to ask questions like this? They live in a bubble? It seems to me they're professionals and they should be somewhat interested in what's going on around them. This is really...
I do think part of it was fear and the possibility of losing their livelihood, and they complied with the hospital rules and regulations regarding the vaccines. And another thing, for anyone who has the vaccine, like, they possibly think, what if that could be me? I mean, they're taking care of patients they're probably asking themselves, what if this was me?
Are they beginning to realize that the immune system is failing? It's dying in these people. Are they beginning to? Yes. Are they beginning to understand yet that the immune system has been attacked and destroyed?
Yeah, they're seeing all of that. It's very evident now that it's. But the question is what does one do in this scenario? I mean, you're seeing it, and then you have an institution saying.
But do they know? Excuse me, Anne. Do they know what's going on here? Do they know that the immune system has been destroyed? I know they're seeing it. I get that. But do they know that they have a patient with no immunological competence anymore? Do they know that?
I do believe, because a few of them mentioned that they were doing some of their own research now. And that was the first time I actually heard them say that. Now, the previous hospital that I worked in before I went to this one, we talked about this all the time, and there was a lot of discussion about it. So we were seeing it when we were on the front line the first time around, and we amongst ourselves as nurses would ask those questions. This particular hospital I'm in, the nurses who would have asked the questions probably are no longer there, because keep in mind they do realize that there's an immune system attack, and that it's through the blood. This is the sophistication of it all. It's through the blood because there's not one patient that hasn't presented with clots in some form. Not one.
Wow. Erica?
Yeah, as we were talking about earlier, I think that the first target of this shot, the spike protein, is the blood. And from there, it just goes downhill. And the way the shot works, the injection works, is completely brutal, unnatural. I mean, you're asking your body's cells to produce a lethal protein.
And did you
maybe
see
some
what
people can neutralize it and maybe others can't.
Right. And did you see in the last hour the pictures of blood after someone has been injected? Go ahead.
Yeah, yes, I do. Yes, I want to talk to you about that. So this is classically what I'm seeing as well. So, you know, as nurses, we have to draw daily labs on the patients that are in the hospital. We're monitoring daily labs.
Sure.
And what's happening is the IVs that we put in for, if there's fluid that isn't constantly running in through the IV gets clotted up. That's the first thing. And then if you have to draw blood, and you don't have a central line to draw the blood out of, and you have to go in through their veins, the blood, when we're using the butterfly apparatus, the blood is so thick it won't come through the tube. And it's black. It's jet black. So it's common all the time. All the time. 100% this is happening. So
jet
what happens
black
is
blood.
Is when we can no longer get the veins to give us blood.
Right.
We end up having to have the doctors put in a central line. And then we try to access the blood through a central line. So you get a little bit more flow and powerful flow through a central line as opposed to just from the regular vein. But even then the central lines are also clotting if they're not getting infusions or fluids through there.
Central line would go into an artery. Most likely,
correct.
It sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You go to a subclavian artery, or they'll do the jugular sometimes as well.
Really? Oh.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so all of you people in there are seeing, you're doing your daily labs, you got to draw blood. You can't draw blood. You're seeing jet black blood that barely comes out of somebody. I would think that this would scare the living daylights out of some of your friends and coworkers. They'd say, what the hell's going on here? This is not how blood is supposed to be. They surely see it.
I do remember saying to one of the patients, and I didn't mean to say it, but I go, this is classic COVID blood. I had been in the vein and I was trying to draw blood from a patient and it bled through the butterfly tubing and then stopped. It wouldn't flow anymore.
Classic vaxxed COVID blood.
I just said classic COVID blood, but yes.
Wow. And thank you. That was really remarkable. Erica, you have another question for her? We just have 2 minutes left, so go ahead if you do.
Well, no, that what she said, you know, the classic COVID blood, that's what they were seeing early on in this scamdemic. It was really a clotting disorder, in addition to being a respiratory disorder. And I think that these shots are injecting or causing the person to manifest the disease called COVID, which is essentially a clotting issue, a blood poisoning.
It's essentially an immune destruction.
That
function.
Too. That too.
So, oh my. And again, thank you very much, and Merry Christmas to you and yours from me and Erica.
Yes, Merry Christmas, Anne.
Merry Christmas to you both. Thank you.
Thank you. Hope to see you again when you're ready. Let us know.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Well, Erica?
Yep.
Not changed much, just getting worse and worse.
Well, and getting back to, you know, this is going to be a war on the unvaxxed. Pretty soon, if people don't take the boosters, they will be considered unvaxxed as well.
Correct. Six boosters, eight boosters. Who's counting, right?
That's the game. And I know many people who have been injured by one shot, sometimes two shots, and there's just no way they're going to go for a booster. So there's going to be a lot of unvaxxed, technically unvaxxed out there shortly.
Well, okay, there you have it. 2 hours, we'll put them up there separately and you can share them. I hope you do. Especially with medical personnel, friends who may be professional health staff, whatever. But most of all, share it with yourself so you understand what we're up against. Most of you have a real good grasp of it by now. So, Erica, wish everyone a Merry Christmas, and we'll say goodnight.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
And to all of you, same here, and we really appreciate you. Have a good day. Have a warm and happy day tomorrow. And remember, every day is a blessing. Get the most out of it. We'll talk to you next week.